that up until now she's been a child. She's been tied to her family of origin and subject to them. And now it's time to tend to her own interest. And she says, it's my own vineyard I have not kept. It's time for that now. And vineyards are used throughout the song as a symbol of this love relationship that she's now ready for as a mature woman. So now she's introduced herself. She addresses her, who actually he's not her level yet. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture? Where do you lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who is veiled besides the flocks of your friends? Now, most translators add your flocks following where do you pasture, but these words are not in the text. It doesn't say anything about your sheep or your goats or anything in the text. And what this is a double entendre. Where do you pasture? Where do you lie down at noon? This is a double entendre for sexual play. The woman is seeking an intimate relationship with this person that she's found attractive, and she doesn't hesitate to initiate it. The woman in the song is really quite aggressive in pursuing this relationship. And she also says that she does not want to be like one who is veiled or a vagabond. She doesn't want to be a stranger before this man whom she finds attractive. So this is a very bold introduction and a very obvious request that they have, let's get acquainted, okay? And the man answers and invites her to come to him, and we're skipping that part. And then he praises the way that she looks. And I'm including this here just to give you some ideas about trying to understand this poetry, which has some very strange things it says. He says, I liken you, my darling, to a... Is that a lovely thing to say? She looks like a horse. Harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are comely with ornaments, your necks with strings of jewels. We will make you ornaments of gold studded with silver. Okay. Any clue what he might be saying here?
The horses are beautiful when they're on the chariot.
That's true. The horses are beautiful, and it's highly desirable.
Pharaoh's horses certainly are especially beautiful, I would imagine.
They were lots of jewels.
She's good looking, and she's well arrayed.
Yes.
What's the word? Accessorized.
Accessorized. Yeah, the Pharaoh's horses were beautiful horses, and they were also well done up. They would have jewels on their bridles. And so he's saying, I like the way you look. You're wearing, lots of jewelry and maybe big earrings and probably a ring in your nose. You're comely with ornaments, and I like the way you look. So she says, let's get acquainted, and he says, yeah, you look good to me. Okay. So his first observations are of what she's wearing. She signals her interest in her availability by getting up like this, and he finds her attractive. And then this is followed by an interplay between the two, kind of expressing their desire for each other. And, the king rests in his own room while my perfume spreads its fragrance. That's kind of a symbol of sexual intoxication, kind of sexual attraction there. He says she's beautiful, and then in the next section, it's number four, she says she's just a simple wildflower. I'm a lotus of the plain, a lily of the valley. And he says, like a lily among brambles is my love among women. So she makes this modest statement, and he counters it. And then she returns the compliment with, like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Okay, so as we start to mine the song for its insights into relationships, let's start with this exchange of compliments. If you all remember the first time you fell in love, in the first stages of love, couples tend to see only each other's good points. Okay, and lovers can do no wrong in each other's eyes. The man finds his beloved to be the most beautiful of women. If she says that the sun has scorched her, she's no pampered beauty, she's had to work, right? She's a rose, he says, and compared to her, other women are mere bramble. And she proclaims him to be an apple tree, delicious and comforting among the fruitless trees of the forest. Now, I think this is an important insight that the poem is capturing there, that you do have this initial rush of enthusiasm, of love blindness for each other. And this is really, it's important, and this is why sex is important for relationships. If you don't find someone attractive, you're not going to proceed any farther in creating a relationship with them. So the first effect of sex, then, is the attraction that makes the lovers seek out each other's company. This mutual enthusiasm, this blind enthusiasm, is also critical in the lovers developing emotional closeness. In their book on intimacy, the Lester write, any sense of judgment or rejection by a spouse blocks intimacy. Feeling part of the self is disliked makes it difficult to let any part of the self be known. Likewise, ridicule from either partner makes it difficult to feel intimate. So if the relationship is to grow in this early stages, the lover's judgments needs to be in each other's favor, and they need to feel accepted and that the other person finds them attractive. And as if to make Lester's point for them, following the lover's expression of his regard for her, the woman makes a very intimate statement of sexual longing. She says, oh, that his left arm were under my head and his right hand should caress me. And actually, it's this phrase, which is repeated a few times throughout the song, that LaHaye used to build their sex manual around. And you can tell, I don't want to get too explicit on the tape here, because I have but LaHaye says that this refers to clitoral stimulation, and they actually, it's a nice little sex manual, The Act of Marriage, that they wrote. It's about 25 years old now, but it's obviously, even if it's not that, it's obviously an intimate posture that she's longing for, because they're lying down. His right arm is under my head, and I mean, his left arm is under my head, and his right hand should correct me. And then she says, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles or the wild does that you do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready. And she's going to say this a few times throughout the song, too. Although the song begins with the woman's desire for her beloved's kisses, and this caress that she yearns for now is far more intimate. But despite her growing desire, the woman isn't rushing into anything prematurely. This is what she's telling the daughters of Jerusalem. You know, don't stir up or awaken love until it's ready. So she's saying, there's more, wait. The woman initiated the courtship, but in the next passage, her beloved comes to her, and there's a long passage on here. I'm going to just read part of it. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our walls, gazing in the window, looking in through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, with me. See, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing it has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land. Okay, so she's just said, let's not go so fast, daughters of Jerusalem. You know, let love take its own time. And he's coming with this energy of bounding energy and passion, the gazelle or the young stag bounding over the mountains, and saying, come on, let's go. Okay. And then he says, skip a little bit, catch us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, for our vineyard is in blossom. Okay, so at the beginning she said, I haven't kept my own vineyard. He's saying, come now and tend to your vineyard. The diminutive nature of the chore requiring her attention, however, which is catching the little foxes, I mean, that's cute, right? He's not calling her to hard labor like her brothers did, but he wants her to attend to the business of love. So it's this call and response. And her response to him now is come to me. But love is still not quite ready. We need to read more here. We have what I call the first vignette. It's on number 7 on your handout. And the woman says, all night long on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. Now, this sounds a little lame, like how big is her bed that she can't find her lover in it, right? What she's saying is probably the equivalent of I tossed and turned all night. You know, I'm thinking of, dreaming of my lover, and he's not there. I looked for him, but did not find him. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will search for the one my soul loves. So I looked for him but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed him when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my house. And then we have, again, cautioning the daughters of Jerusalem not to stir or wake it up love until it's ready. This passage, which I refer to as the first vignette, acknowledges the perfectly normal and desirable hesitation to commit oneself to another person. The couple's relationship so far has been attraction that ripened into sexual desire, but they've not yet come together. Perhaps as a result of her tossing and turning, the woman decides that she's ready for more, but her lover, unwarned, isn't there. So, you know, she's always willing to take the initiative, so she gets up and goes searching for him and finds him and brings him to her mother's chamber, which I think is a poetic way of saying that we were born for each other, or it's inevitable, and later they'll go to where his mother conceived him. Okay, so although the woman will hesitate once more before the lovers come together, the action in this vignette marks a deepening of the couple's commitment to each other. After this point, the man for the first time begins to refer to the woman as his spouse or his promised bride. And then the next passage, which we won't read, invokes the presence of King Solomon, and it's like, here comes Solomon in all his might and majesty, and it's sort of, our relationship has become so that it's befits the notice of the king. It's important now. Let's skip a passage here. And at this newly at stage in their relationship, the man praises his beloved in more intimate terms than he's used before. He's said she's beautiful and she's a lily and so forth. But now he's going to get specific. And there's some pretty funny images in here. I'm going to stop and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I want to hit a couple of them. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veils. Maybe they flutter. They're mobile. Your hair is like a flock of goats frisking down the slopes of Gilead. Now, to me, this has got to be a little worse than you look like a horse. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Goats don't smell too good. What do you suppose that he's trying to get at here?
Curly and alive.
Yeah, curly and alive. A goat by itself, you know, isn't too attractive. But he says you're a flock. It's like a flock of goats flowing down the side of a mountain. So you're getting this image of flowing, curly hair movement. That's much more attractive, isn't it? So we have to make some translations here. The next one is fun, too. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. Each one has its twin, and not one of them is bereaved. You make me feel a little fuzzy. What do you suppose he's saying there? Remember, these were much poorer times, and people did not have dental care. Having your own teeth, all of your teeth, was a characteristic worthy of note. You could be beautiful just because you still had a full set of teeth. So when they say your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes, they've just shorn, so they're clean, and they're coming up from the washing, you're white. Each one has its twin, and none of them are bereft. She has all her teeth. Okay, and then he says some other things, your lips, your cheeks, your neck. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. This one gave me a hard time because I couldn't help but, you know, visual image and like two heads and four eyes and nostrils. And how about if this isn't a visual image, though? Your breasts are like two fawns, the twins of a gazelle. What other senses senses could we be calling on here? Pardon me?
Beautiful.
They're beautiful. Yes, soft. Like babies are so soft, baby animals. How about motion? Yeah.
Well, when the animal's feet and head is down, there are no noses or eyes. There's just a nice, smooth, round bottom.
Nice, smooth, round bottom. He's feeding among the lilies there, and this is what we see. Okay. So they feed among the lilies. The head feeds among the lilies, and the bottom follows. Okay. All right. So when you're reading the song, don't insist on sticking with just kind of one sense when you're trying to figure out what it meant. I thought he could be saying too that you know, you're perky and bouncy, you know? like the fawns. Okay. So then he says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peaks of Amana, from the peak of Sinner and Hermon, from the den of lions, from the mountains of lepers." Now, this is getting kind of scary here. "A garden locked is my sister, my promised bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. The woman has her lover, tells her, ravished his heart." But in all this description of her beauty and her lips and her breasts and so forth, he's describing a tantalizing love that's not yet attained. She's still his promised one, not yet realized, a garden, a fountain sealed. Although the woman's yearning for her man was such that she braved the dark city streets in order to find him, even after her surrender, she's still veiled. And this is something you see up in a previous verse. "The woman has not yet surrendered her own defenses or committed herself. When he asks her to depart from the peaks of Ammon, to come away from the dens of lions and the mountains of leopards, he's asking her to come away from the dangers of uncertainty." Commitment, no matter how desirable the person or action we commit ourselves to, is always a sacrifice on some level. Commitment opens the door to a whole new world, but it's always a loss, always a wounding, because we're saying, this one and no other. I'm choosing this path. I can't go the other direction. And so this is why the woman is hesitating here. Also, this idealized relationship that I'm going to have to cover in 5 minutes, looks like.
I'm going to be really loose.
Okay. This idealized relationship that's coming, this one flesh relationship, it's very demanding. And you can't have this kind of relationship with someone who's not trustworthy. So I think the woman's hesitation here is really commendable. I think it's an important part of the song, that she really wants to be sure of her lover and of herself before she makes a commitment to him. Now, the man came to... The point of view of this poem is all from the woman's, and so we just know that the man comes to his commitment to her because she goes looking for him in the dark streets. And now he asks the same of her in this passage that we just read. And in the next passage, which I won't read, she offers herself again to her lover, but they still aren't ready to become one flesh yet. We have the second vignette. This is reading number 10. And the woman says, "I sleep, but my heart is awake. I hear my beloved knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had taken off my tunic," she says. Was I to put it on again? "I'd washed my feet. Was I to dirty them again?" The woman was dreaming of her lover, but when he shows up, she's pretty nonplussed. Now, imagine you're 17 or 18 and your hot new sweetheart just arrives unannounced in the middle of the night after you've already gone to bed. Maybe you've only seen each other before at parties where you're all dressed up, and he's only seen her before in her veils and her necklaces. Okay? And he expects her to jump out of bed with her hair uncombed and teeth unbrushed and let him in. And I think her first response to be, she seems to be saying, "I look awful. You know, I took off my tunic. Am I supposed to get all dressed up again? This guy just shows up here." And after her lover's first comments to her had to do with how great she looked, you know, looked like the horse. So how is he going to react to her when she's drowsy? Perhaps the poem doesn't mean to imply that much concern about appearance here. But in any case, the relationship is not yet intimate enough that the woman feels comfortable greeting her beloved, ungroomed in her night clothes and bare feet. Can she trust him to accept her? Moreover, the lover comes to his dove in a less than appealing condition himself. Okay, she's seen him. Oh, he's a great-looking guy. And now he says he's damp from the night dew. So how is she going to respond to him when he's not as cute as in sexually appealing as the first time that she saw him? The second vignette takes the song beyond a simple love poem to a psychological portrait of the true cost of relationships. The lovers, in their besotted state of infatuation, cannot proceed further in their relationship until they come out of their love blindness, see each other, and accept each other as they really are. Attraction, however ardent, does not provide a basis for a true love that lasts must take its own time. So sex has drawn them into the relationship so far, but they have to decide now how much further it's going to be. Also consider that the Song of Songs is not an epic poem in which the lover proves his worthiness by undertaking some ordeal for the beloved's favor. And she doesn't rescue him. He's not going to her to rescue him from some thrilling and gratifying danger. There's nothing very sexy about this. He comes in and he says, "My hair is wet from the dew." The dew, you know. So his predicament isn't exciting. It's pathetic. Love's fantasy comes crashing down. No wonder she hesitates to answer the door. So she has to decide whether she's willing to allow both of them to be themselves, whether they'll give up their pretenses and their always to look good. And this is a hard decision because pretenses can be very nice. A relationship's more pleasant when the other person's always trying to be sweet and kind and considerate and look good and smell good. And the false fronts protects me from being judged and protects my lover from the unpleasant truth about what I really look like all the night. So this is the decision that she has to come to, and so far she's decided no, she's not getting up to open the door. But the next verse, 11, said, "My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening." He actually rattled the doorknob. "And my womb trembled for him." Now this is interesting because the woman is now going to get up and open the door. But she comes to her commitment not because of her passionate desire for this fellow, but because her inner parts or her womb trembled for him. And this is an image not of desire, but of compassion. And with this choice, the song makes an important distinction between love based on the beloved's desirable characteristics and love based on compassion for the other person. Between the blind approval of sexual infatuation and the acceptance that emerges after those first enthusiasms are challenged. And I'm sure you probably all have heard someone give a sacrament meeting talk about the difference between eros, which is passionate love, passionate or erotic love, and agape, love that's motivated by concern for the other person. Lovers of the song who've testified so fervently to each other's beauty and sexual appeal have certainly shown that they have their share of erotic attraction for each other. When we consider the song as a model of marriage, however, we have to ask whether this great love goes any deeper. How will love age when beauty flees and the passions wane? What happens to this great passion when he releases his defenses and asks for consolation from the dew, and when she removes her veil and turns out to be sunburned flesh and blood instead of complete perfection? And of course, this is exactly the situation of the second vignette. And it tells us that only when desire is matched with compassion can the relationship proceed. Ultimately, the woman does not decide in her lover's favor because he's a sexy and heroic man with great hair. She chooses him because she faces his weakness, great and small, and cares for him in spite of them. Further, he trusts that he will accept her. And it's only when she can accept both of their nakedness that she can let go of her own fears and defenses in order to commit herself fully. So then this is what happens next, number 12. "I arose to open to my beloved. My hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh upon the handles of the bolt." So this is an image of yearning and yielding, dripping with myrrh. "I opened for my lover, but my lover had gone. He had left. My soul fled his flight. I sought him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The watchmen came upon me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me, they wounded me, they took away my veil, those sentinels of the wall. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I'm faint with love." So commitment is a sacrifice that you make for another person. Compassion's even more costly. In the first version of the searching story, the woman passed the city watchmen unscathed. In the second, the watchmen beat her up and they take away her veil. So now she's given up her defenses, and that's what this, you know, the watchman beating her symbolizes. And when we give up our defenses, we can be bruised and hurt. And the source of our peril is not just our own unveiled state, but the weaknesses of our lover. But now committed to her lover, the woman gives her first intimate and extended praise of him, which we will skip, but, you know, your head, your eyes, your cheeks, your lips, all beautiful. And then the daughters of Jerusalem say, "Where has your lover gone, most beautiful of women? Which way did your beloved turn so that we can help you look for him?" And she says, "My beloved has gone down to his garden," and we've previously established that she is the garden, "to the bed of spices," and we previously established that she's all spices, "to browse in the garden and to gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He browses among the lilies." So this is a poetic way of saying that they've at last come together, they're united in the garden, and so the fears and the concerns of truly loving, the dangers that we undertake in giving up our defenses to love another person, finally opens the gates of the garden. As previously established, the woman herself is the garden, all spices and the lily, and she began the song by asking to know where he pastured. That was this double entendre, right? And now she knows, and there's no longer any need for the double entendre, he pastures in her. "I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine." This is the conceptual center of the poem. Okay, before you had attraction, getting closer, call and response. They weren't quite ready to get together. Now with the introduction of compassion and acceptance, they are finally one flesh. The Song of Songs demonstrates that the Judeo-Christian scriptures are anything but sexually repressed. The song praises erotic love, and at its core is this fulfillment of... and in fact, you can't get to this state where they are without sexuality. You can't have this marriage relationship without that. But true marriage, just as true marriage can't come to pass without sexual longing, desire can't lead beyond itself without concern and sacrifice for the beloved. And indeed, in the scriptures, the reason for sexual control are more romantic than they are repressive. Let's see. So they praise each other quite a bit. And there's some interesting things about Solomon and all his wives. But let's go to number 14 in the readings. And this is the lover speaking to his beloved. He's been praising how beautiful she is. And he says, "How beautiful you are, how charming, my love, my delight. In stature like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters." We're talking about a date palm here. "I will climb the palm tree," I resolved. "I will seize its clusters of dates. Oh, may your breasts be like the clusters of grapes, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine." Okay, these aren't visual images here. These are gustatory images. These are images of consumption, of taste, of smell. So Ape has moved the lovers beyond the titillation of Eros to its satisfaction. This is all images of sexual satisfaction here. And the woman's response is also in terms of sexual fulfillment. May the wine go straight to my lover, moving gently over lips and teeth. "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the fields. We will spend the night in the villages, and in the mornings we will go to the vineyards. We will see if the vines are budding, if their blossoms are opened, and if the pomegranate trees are in flowers. There I will give you my love." Mandrakes give forth fragrance. Mandrakes were thought to be an aphrodisiac. "And at the door is every delicacy, new as well as old. I have stored them for you, my beloved." This image of not only sexual fulfillment, but their love has met their needs on other levels as well. And if you read back through the poem, the couple in the song have no cares or responsibilities. The man is lover, bridegroom, and king, but he's never a husband. He doesn't do any work. He carries no sword. The woman is lover, bride, and daughter of a prince, but she never acts the role of wife. But despite this lack of industry, all fruit, spice, and wine is theirs, and this abundance is taken for granted. And I would argue that you say, well, you know, it's easy to keep your love, your vineyards in blossom when life is one long vacation. How many marital problems would go away if you didn't have any material cares? But the poem makes it pretty clear that their wealth, their material wealth, is the result of their love, not the other way around. Okay, so in a one flesh relationship, remember the one flesh was from Genesis 2, from creation. It makes possible the blessings of Genesis 1, which was the abundance of the earth. So they don't have any cares because of this love. And the next passage for me is the most powerful in the song. The woman says, set me like a seal upon your heart. This is number 16. Set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm. For love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Love no flood can quench, no torrents drown. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. Seals were used to mark personal property, like if you put your name on something, it marks it as yours. But further, seals functioned in the place of signature as an expression of one's assent or will. The heart was where the will was formed, and the arm was what carried it out. And there's this beautiful ambiguity in what the woman's saying here. Set me like a seal upon your heart, like a seal upon your arm. Write my name on your heart, is what she's saying. Now, does that make your heart mine or my name yours? So it's this real, the lovers are together not only in one flesh, but in one will, in one mind, in one spirit as well. And neither fire, flood, financial cares, nor ultimately the grave can take this away from him. I'm going to skip the part about the little sister with her breasts, which is a little odd. But the woman says, I have become in his eyes like one who brings contentment. And then the next one is 19. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. Remember, we started out talking about vineyards. He entrusted the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. So the keepers sold the fruit and gave Solomon 1,000 pieces of silver. After my vineyard myself, you, O Solomon, may keep the 1,000, and those who oversee its produce, their 200. Solomon and the keepers of his vineyards, who were his many wives, were well reimbursed for their relationships, which were based on kind of material concerns. They were mostly political in nature. But however wealthy, they're only landlords and tenants. But I, the woman says, I tend my own vineyard. Her relationship is based on pure, and she pays neither rent nor wages to anyone. She and her beloved have it all. What the lovers have at the end of the song is a thing of aching beauty. The woman came to her lover, a young girl, a stranger who just left her childhood, veiled and outside the man's circles of friends. At the end of the song, she is an all-provident woman, living in the garden, and his friends are hers. She's surrounded by friends of her own. She's a tower of protection, all her lover could ever want, and in her he finds contentment. Her own vineyards that were untended at the beginning, the lovers now end up richer than Solomon. The Song of Songs creates a powerful picture of what marriage can be, a relationship of trust, respect, complete giving, complete having, self-sacrifice, overwhelming abundance, and true unity, a relationship that captures entirely the one flesh ideal of Christ, Peter, Paul, and creation. The song answers in part the question of why God made humankind male and female. Sexual desire is the hook that draws the lovers into relationships, growing from sexual attraction with its blind and affirming acceptance to commitment, to compassion, to sexual fulfillment, to peace and play. The song ends with the lovers so deep in love and trust with each other that they are each other's will, completely one flesh, and they have everything. Commitment, compassion, and peace, then, it's not like we've switched from sex to agape love and compassion, but rather compassion is part of what it means to be a sexual being. It's all part of the whole notion of coming to two people coming together as one. So in presenting this ideal of marriage, the Song of Songs placement in the Bible is not an anomaly or a mistake. It gives us a very important picture of what marriage was intended to be and at what we should be aiming for.
I've really appreciated the opportunity to read this paper. Had it for a couple of days, and I wish that I'd... Carrie, when she heard I was going to respond, we exchanged a couple of emails, and she said, it'll be great fun to have you, who actually knows something of the Old Testament, talking about this, and I only wish that she was right, and I could really give you the story with the depth that I should. But this, in fact, is a book that I've never studied at all until this point, and I'm glad to have had that opportunity. One of the things that we tend to view all Scripture as sort of like it's there and God inspired it and put it in the Bible. And of course, the Bible evolved. It got there somehow. And the books that are included got into the Bible somehow. And with a lot, you know, the Bible, the Old Testament can be cut into different sections, but the writings mostly got in there because people loved them. Okay, that people, the book of Esther, the book of Job, the book of, what am I trying to think of? Anyway, and this one, clearly, Ecclesiastes, I was trying to think of. They were writings that appealed to people's souls, and they wouldn't live without them, and they became the treasured things that people read over the pulpit, that they sang on the Sabbath, that became part of their religion. Okay, and so they have a hymn book that grew. Nobody, no church committee decided, here's what's going to be in the hymn book, here's what's going to be in the Bible. Okay, that they were the things that people loved. And the fact that this is in the Bible is a testament to the fact that people wanted and used this in their religion. They used it in marriage ceremonies. Okay, they sang these songs. And not because of who wrote it. I mean, the chances that Solomon wrote the Song of Solomon are about equal to the chances that Roland wrote the Song of Roland. Okay. What else did I want to say about any of this? What I appreciate what Carrie's done. I've always enjoyed her presentation. She wants to enrich our lives by showing us meaning that we may have missed in the Scriptures, in the Old Testament, in the writings that we have. And I've appreciated this. I have, if I wanted to quibble, I could spend a lot of time saying, does the Song of Solomon really contain this message or not? Okay, I mean, she's interpreted the entire book as sort of one progression of love. Almost every commentator sees it as a set of at least five and possibly many more poems, each of which with its own story to tell. And not necessarily progression, although they have such similar images. There's a real unity among them. Whether you can really trace a deepening, it's great to read that stuff in. I do it all the time when I teach Sunday school. The process of interpreting Scripture, I mean, she said something, you know, it's a poem, and with any great literature, what is there, what matters about what's there is what you get out of it. And to a great extent, that's true. In religion, we try to say that, you know, the intention with which it was written and the thing that it's supposed to communicate to you is something you ought to be getting out of it. But in the case of this one, I think that it really makes a lot of sense to try to find out what we can get out of it. Okay, the thing of what makes good poetry, okay, is depth of imagery, depth of symbolism that allows you to find new levels of meaning all the time. And there isn't just one meaning to most great literature. And in particular, what I have a sentence I wanted to say here. Great poetry makes great scripture precisely because it is susceptible of multiple interpretations. As we bring our deepening life experience and our progressing social awareness and zeitgeist, it need not become outmoded, but rather can remain fresh with insights inspiring useful imagery. Okay. What I wanted to say about that is I came to this book, I was really excited by the idea of reading the Song of Solomon because my own opinion is that we get extremely little over the pulpit, that's positive about sex. Okay, in our theology, my own opinion, our theology is phenomenally wonderful about sex. Okay, and I learned that as a kid. I actually bought the idea that God had a body and he enjoyed it. Okay, and that we were going to eternally, and that that was good, and it helped to inoculate me personally against 99% of what I ever heard about it in church being what you shouldn't be doing. But that is the rhetoric in the church about sexuality, about men and women. There's a fascinating talk that has been discussed among some of us, the priesthood session of the last conference, in which Elder Scott tries to talk about men and women, and he says a few positive things, like, you know, that fathers need to listen to their daughters and praise them for their strengths and da-da-da-da-da. But mostly, it's urging us to standard conservative forms of dress and modes of interaction, and a huge emphasis toward the end on, mostly anti-pornography. My own opinion is that there's a big push coming in the church, I'm going to guess, that pornography is becoming a bigger and bigger problem, and that the church is going to be looking for a way to deal with this. And if they just continue to criminalize everything, and the rhetoric that we get is the criminalizing rhetoric, it's not going to move people past the sort of simplistic right and wrong aspects. And that what Kerry is doing here, and what I hoped for from the Song of Songs, is a richness of imagery that leads us to a positive, hopeful, affirmative embrace of our sexuality that makes cheapened forms of sexuality unattractive. Okay, and for my own experience, I actually really bought all that good stuff when I was a kid, and hopefully I do still somewhat. I remember being in Boy Scouts and going on a scout camp, and some kids had, I think it was the kids, had brought some Playboy, okay? And it was my first encounter with images like that, okay? And I was not judgmental, but I was in fact repulsed, okay? It just felt cheap. It felt dirty and mundane and profane, and I feel like, to the extent that we can enrich our hopes for sexuality, our sense of what it can be, that other things will be less attractive, okay? And I wanted that in the Song of Solomon. Now, there's a real question. I sat down with my girlfriend. We read it through. I read the man's part. She read the woman's part. And it's very positive. But it's mostly, and I advise that if you have somebody like that that you'd like to read the scriptures with, it's really really wonderful. And it's you'll find your own meanings and. I don't want to get carried away here, but you will find your own meanings. And we worried about when he was out browsing among the lilies. Wait a minute. She just said, my love is mine and I am his, and now he's out browsing among the lilies? What is that? It's partially actually a statement that while he's out, to me it was a statement that while he's away from me, he's still mine, okay? He can be out there in the world, and I don't have to worry. You know, I still have a reassurance that we are each other's, but she's a little worried about it sometimes. Okay, what was I going to say? There's a lot more meanings to find in here that I just love some of the things. The portraits of passion, the symbolic transcendence, when she sees, Kerry interprets the big image of Solomon as the king notices them. Okay, I think when you experience the thrill of love, it almost becomes like you're worthy of the notice, not of a king, but do a king. Okay, that somehow love is transcendent, okay? It becomes more symbolic. It's not so mundane. It gets lifted out of this life and becomes much more powerful and more meaningful, and you feel like, you know, you're the king, you're Solomon, you've got this big train, and it's, you know, we're coming up out of, you know, it's something worth everybody noticing the way that they notice a king. The image of come away from those mountains, come away from Lebanon, from the mountains of Ammonah, come away from the den of lions and the mountains of leopards. Okay, I read, you know, there's a, out there alone is a dangerous place. It's a foreign land. The true home, the true place, Israel, come away from Lebanon, come home to where there's safety and where there's security. And but dens of lions in the mountains. I asked somebody who had, who said, "Yeah, well, that's the meat market thing. It is dangerous out there. And come to a safer place where we will protect each other from that. It's not just indecision. It's insecurity out there in the world." Okay, I've got. There's. You'll find your own meanings. That's the point of all that. Let's see. Okay, I want to go through things here in some degree of order, although we're running out of time. How are we doing? Oh God. Okay. So I encourage projects like this. I really would love to see. Okay. The question is, okay, Carrie has given a wonderful, positive feeling about what sexuality is, how we ought to be integrating our sexuality with our love. Elder Scott tried to do that in the final paragraph of his talk at the priesthood session. He talked about having been married to a woman for many years who was a faithful and graceful daughter of God and all that kind of stuff, and that's really wonderful, but it leaves out all the passion of the Song of Solomon. It leaves out the fascination and the thrill and all of that kind of stuff. And the question is, you know, this book is scripture, okay? The Jews read it that way. They delighted in it. What would it take for us as more, you know, what would it take for, I mean, Elder Scott will never do it, but for Elder Holland to give a talk like that in General Conference, okay? Could we accept it? Would we accept it? Would Mormons not be able to view things like that? Could we say things like that over our own pulpits and in our own marriage ceremonies? We would be beginning to integrate more parts of our lives. When we dam parts up, I mean, this pop psychology, but it goes clear back to Freud, you dam up your enjoyment of really important drives that you have, and it comes out in perverse ways. It's the true integration and the appreciation and the of all of our parts that's going to make us healthy again. Bob Reese yesterday talked about one of the reasons of coming to Sunstone to be to realize the imaginative possibilities of our religion, and we need to do that. We need to read the scriptures this way, as Carrie has done. Her paper is a testimony to the possibility of that sort of thing really working. I wanted to mention the final passage. Carrie's translation, she's given us her cobbled together version, which is really wonderful, and I really like what she's done with almost everything. Toward the very end, her favorite part that starts out with the seal on the heart and on the arm, love is strong as death, passion as relentless as Sheol. The flash of it is a flash of fire. She says a mighty flame, okay? What it literally says is the flame from God, from Jehovah, okay, from Yahweh. Okay, that there is something divine. As 1 John says, when we love, we're participating in God's love. Okay, there is something actually genuinely divine about the flame that is love. Okay, and when we're participating in it, we're participating in something that's divine. That's probably enough. There's what I wanted to say was, I actually had trouble finding the depth of relationship in this book that I wanted to find and that Carrie did find. There's a lot of external stuff, okay? You know, she's a sex object, okay? All over and over and over, he's enjoying her pomegranate-like cheeks and her fawn-like breasts and whatever it is. And even toward the end, when she praises him, it's just how good-looking he is. On the other hand, a couple of things. There are things toward the end that have this sort of depth. When I see his glasses, you know, I reach into his soul. That kind of thing comes out. Also wanted to say, within its context, okay, she read a passage where he comes to the wall and he's walled off from her. And he looks in at the lattice and he invites her out to enjoy the joys of spring because the time of rain is over and the doves are flying in the fields and blah, 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 blah. If you read Eastern and Greek poetry at the same time, I'm told, I don't read any of it myself, but it's always people are complaining that the door is locked, that there's a wall there, okay? They're not inviting her out. There's not a reciprocity. There's not a permission giving. This is actually a fairly enlightened for its time sense of what it is for men and women to relate. We need to do the same thing within our day. But because it's poetry, because it doesn't ossify over time, we can read in some more of our sensibilities and the things we think we've learned in our day. Anyway, thanks very much for your paper.
I'd like to thank Carrie and Kim for their comments. And I think we have about, I'm going to be really generous and say 5 minutes for questions. Does anybody have any questions for either one?
We both went over. We apologize.
Yes.
This is for both of you, actually. I like, Kim, what you had said about the fact that we need to get a healthier perspective, a healthier look at sexual relationships. My question would be regarding our children. How do we teach our children to have that healthy view?
The question is, how do we teach our children to have that healthy view?
I have no children, so I can speak authoritatively on that. Carrie with two will have a problem. My mother's here. You should, which was always interesting, the thing about preparing this and possibly my mother being here. I actually wanted to... It's funny because we didn't actually talk about sex. I actually believe that when I was at a reasonable age, I had a really, really positive feeling about this. I believe that it wasn't a matter of condemnation, but there was immense respect for sexuality in my family, okay? I actually believe, I am blessed by the fact that I never used vulgar language as a kid, okay? I shunned that sort of stuff. To me, bodily parts were really sacred, and we used jargon in our family that was respectful of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a small thing, but it's a really big thing. And we didn't swear. We didn't use language that cheapened our bodies or our experiences with each other. I think that's one thing I'm really grateful for. And you know, I never saw, you know, there was never a sense, you know, well, you guys don't have to be taught this, but you know, the sense that sex was cheap was not part of my experience, okay, as a kid, and I really appreciate that. I also believe that just helping people, I mean, for me, the theology, I think, is what did it. I had this, you know, as I was a teenager, and they were beginning to, you know, lambast us with all this negative, I mean, I shouldn't say too negative, but, you know, forbidding stuff about sex, which, I mean, she points out the value of restraint, the value, it's really good paper in talking about the value of restraint and holding back and making decisions that are good. I think you have to trust at a certain level that kids are going to figure out good stuff. This may be harder today. I mean, the media is so overwhelming and so powerful and all these images out there. I just want to tell you one little story I've never told my mother. When I was like 15, I had this incredible dream. Okay, there was a girl who matched all these descriptions. She was very dark, and she was brilliant. She was, you know, I admired her on every level. And I had a dream one night, walking out of my house and finding her in front of the house, and the two of us who had never managed to really love each other, embracing each other and slowly collapsing on the grass and making love. Okay, and it was so beautiful, and it was so sensitive, and I woke up from that feeling like God had told me, "This is good." Okay, this is good. It's not, I didn't feel permission to go out and do it the next day. I was being told how beautiful it could be when it was right. And I think that God will bless us that way. And the church, if we listen to the doctrines and not all the admonitions, but the depth of the stuff, will teach us that. And that's enough. Carrie should, with
you. There's nothing left to say.
I would say, as far as working with kids and sexuality, turn off the television, because they're getting this incredible message. And their message is, oh, sex is wonderful, but the sex is, you know, this is deep. There's no depth to the kind of relationship they're getting on television. And I think that they will see that in your relationship with their mother. I mean, not sexuality, but the love and commitment. And I really think kids need to be shielded from all the stuff that's going on out there. It's not like when I was a kid.
I was stunned. I never watched television practically, and I went on a youth retreat, okay, up to the mountains, and they were watching these shows with these people, exposing these weird things about their lives and all this sex. And I went and I turned off the TV and I said, this is garbage, you guys. You want to know about sex, you talk to me, you talk to Connie, you talk to some of these people, we will tell you about what it's like. This is just voyeuristic garbage. Anyway, Chris.
Yeah, real quick.
One
more question. When we talked about the images and the positive versus negative images, and just last week, I was back to school lab with my 14-year-old daughter, and a little girl comes up I never met, gives her a hug, and she says, oh, I'm Tori's twin, only I've got bigger boobies. You know, and, you know, one side of my mind is I'm always grateful when a 15-year-old girl will come up and describe her body parts to me. But I thought, when I was younger, and I didn't think I was that inhibited, but the thought of saying that to a total stranger never would have happened, and I'm thinking maybe they need a few more negative things over the phone. I mean, they have no hang-ups about their bodies at all. And, you know, and it scares me a little bit. I don't know. So I'm ambiguous, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to people being told take this stuff seriously, and I don't want to push that we shouldn't say any things to get people to restrain themselves, but it needs to be accompanied, and not just accompanied, but the good picture of what it is needs to be in there. I see a lot of the young women that I know wearing really sort of baggy clothes and hiding their sexuality. It's like there still are people who aren't out there to exhibit it and want to sort of keep some of that hidden a little. Anyway, probably not.
I know we'd love to discuss this more, but we'll have to cut this off. Thank you for coming.
Don't read it in the King James translation.
Yeah,
okay. Read it in something you can understand and get it.
I just took her stuff together. And that's what.